I'd like now to welcome to the program Christopher Bohm. He's the director of the Jane Goodall Research Center and professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And he's author of the new book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. He will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much.
So the problem of explaining these qualities, virtue, altruism, shame, from an evolutionary perspective, before there was an evolutionary perspective, as I understand, there was pretty much a God perspective, a religious perspective on things like altruism. Why is altruism a problem in terms of evolutionary science?
Well, it's such a problem that it's preoccupied literally thousands of scholars since 1975, when Edward O. Wilson first got us all interested in this. And the problem is that evolution is a theory which says that everyone is trying to maximize his or her own reproductive success. And if we're all hell-bent on reproducing as much as possible and gaining every advantage we can, then where is the room in this system for someone to basically do something nice for somebody else? Basically, you're giving away your own product to someone else, and therefore your competitive position is lowered and theirs is raised relative to you. And the genes that make people altruistic should simply go away in a hurry.
And at the same time, on an intuitive level to a layman like me, it seems fairly clear that there would be altruism just because nobody can survive as an individual. There's no such thing, at least in species like ours, or in most species, I take it, as individual survival. You need groups of beings and, in fact, ecosystems in order to survive at all.
Well, yes. Humans are a cooperative species. And that is where we get the sort of big intellectual puzzle about altruism. How can we cooperate if, as individuals, we're more or less doomed by the nature of natural selection to be selfish? There's still another way of looking at this, and that is just through common sense. Take a look around you and see whether people are truly selfish or not. And the common sense answer is no. I mean, people give blood anonymously at blood banks all the time. Of course, sometimes they give buildings to universities and want their name pasted all over the building, in which case we will not count that as altruistic because they're getting benefits. But sometimes they give anonymously, and much of giving is anonymous. And that is our true puzzle. That is where we see altruism at work. We also know that cooperative societies such as humans have are based on goodwill as well as mere obligation and contract. So altruism is all around us, and yet we can't explain easily how it could have evolved.
How do you define altruism?
Well, from the standpoint of an everyday person who's simply using the word in its normal sense, it means basically being nice to someone else without getting a reward. Technically, it means giving away something that is of interest to your own reproductive success to somebody who is not a close kin person or kinsperson. Because if you invest in your own children, for example, that's not altruism. That's nepotism in common sense parlance. But it's also, technically, it should not hurt your reproductive success. Because if I give a little bit to my children and it helps them a great deal, and we share 50% of our genes, then I'm the beneficiary. My genes are the beneficiary, and the altruistic genes, or in this case, nepotistic genes, we should say, will not be driven out of the gene pool, because someone who invests well in their own children will prosper compared to someone who doesn't.
You write in your book that human beings tend to be driven by ego, nepotism, and altruism in that order. How did you come to that?
Just by sitting and thinking about it, and also by reading quite a bit of theory in evolutionary theory. Darwin himself said that basically individuals are out for themselves as far as their heredity is concerned. They have to be, because the ones who aren't, their heredities are going to dwindle, and the heredities of the ones who are out for themselves are going to increase. And Darwin himself tackled the problem of altruism. His explanation has held up to a certain degree, but certainly not fully. And his explanation was simply that if you have a group of people who are mostly altruistic, and you have another group who are mostly non-altruistic and selfish, and these two groups get into a fight with each other, which happens with the hunter-gatherers who we look at as evolutionary models, the group of altruists is going to cooperate. And even though their altruism is going to hurt them individually in terms of their genetic success, their group, however, is going to overwhelm the other group. And therefore, altruism could be selected by group selection as opposed to selection at the individual level, which is what we've been talking about up till now.
So an altruistic group of hunter-gatherers, let's say you've got a few hundred people in a band of hunter-gatherers, not of all of whom are, I suppose they're all related. I mean, we have to define what related
means. No, they
means.
Aren't related. Typical hunting band is composed of multiple families that are not related. So when they cooperate, it is altruistic. And that's why our puzzle is such a big one.
So when they behave in an altruistic manner toward each other, in a hunter-gatherer band, what would that look like?
Well, here's exactly what it looks like. You have a band of, let's say, 25 people, maybe five families, of whom there are a few maybe siblings, but most of the people are totally unrelated. And this band of people, when it comes to getting vegetable foods, they are perfectly happy just to cooperate at the family level, which is explained by nepotism theory. That is, relatives helping each other, parents helping their offspring especially. But when it comes to meat, and I'm talking about large game, which has been a primary food for humans for a quarter of a million years, when it comes to meat, these people share the meat equally throughout the band, even though maybe one or two hunters are killing almost all the meat. So these guys are big altruists. But in a sense, they may be altruists while they're at their prime, but when they become old, then some other big altruist is going to be helping everybody. So to a certain degree, it all levels out. But to another degree, it doesn't. We call it indirect reciprocity. That is, in a hunting band, if you're a very good hunter, you figure, I'm really provisioning half the band right now and doing the lion's share of this. But at some point, someone else is going to take over that role, and I'm going to get some back. Maybe not exactly the amount back that I gave, but at least it's going to help me. And that's the psychology of it. Now, the genetics of it is that the band as a whole is sharing meat, and that there is definitely altruism going on. So we do have that puzzle.
Well, the band is sharing meat, and because everybody has that amount of protein in their diet, the whole band is strong, which presumably is why they are more likely to survive. Is that the logic?
Well, that logic only carries about halfway, because the nature of hunting bands everywhere in the world, there are at least 339 of them that have been studied. Nature of these bands is that they are always porous. That is, people are moving back and forth together from one band to another all the time. And this movement really means that the bands don't have boundaries. In a sense, they're just nodes in a network of social life that extends way beyond one band to different bands. And people are constantly moving back and forth. So let's say I stay in one band for a while and I'm getting a lot of meat because I'm not a good hunter and another guy is. And then I move to another band and maybe I'm the best hunter there. So you never know what's going on in terms of looking at a single band competing with other bands. It's more like a huge nexus of bands with people cooperating across bands.
We're talking to anthropologist Christopher Bohm. So you're the director of the Jane Goodall Research Center, and you know more than a little bit about chimps as well as human communities. When you look at, for example, hunter-gatherers and the way they cooperate when they get some very valuable food versus looking at chimps, what do you see? What are the similarities? What are the differences in the way they share or don't share?
Well, chimps are hunters. They love meat. They only eat maybe 5% of their diet to 10% in meat, but it's their favorite food, clearly. They really love it. And chimpanzees have very rudimentary moves in the direction that humans have taken, if you want to look at it that way. When chimpanzees kill, let's say, a large colobus monkey or a baby bush pig, which is quite a bit of meat in either case, their sharing is very different from hunter-gatherers. A hunter-gatherer, when they make a kill, they actually make sure that a dominant male will not take over the kill or feel proprietary about it. And the way they make sure that he doesn't monopolize the meat and use it for his own political and also nutritional purposes is they put someone else in charge of dividing the meat up. Now, when a chimp kills, let's say, a baby bush buck, which would be a little antelope, if it's a high-ranking male who kills the animal, he'll preside over it, and he'll share with a few cronies, but not with everybody, and they're going to be a whole bunch of beggars, and the scene is just chaos, unless you understand what's going on, because the beggars are all fighting each other for position in line, and they're very unlikely to get anything at all, but they're so intent on the meat that they fight or quarrel. In the meanwhile, the dominant individual, who's either killed the animal or has confiscated it from a lower-ranking individual who's killed it, he gives some meat to his girlfriend, to his relatives, to his political ally, and basically shuts most of them out. So chimpanzee sharing is very different from human sharing. It does not have this idea of everyone in the group has a right to some meat.
It's interesting that you write about how there's basically a kind of enforced humility in some of the hunter-gatherer tribes that have been studied. In other words, if somebody says, I'm a great hunter, they get punished.
Absolutely. Hunter-gatherers are intent on two things. One is seeing that meat is shared equally, and the other is that political power is shared equally. And we're talking about the male hunters in the group. If they're female hunters, they would be probably counted as well. But often the females don't hunt. We call it egalitarianism. And egalitarianism means, in hunter-gatherer bands, that no male can become a dominant bully in the group. And not only that, but if any male makes a move in that direction, he's quickly put down. They're very preemptive in making sure that every male retains his full autonomy and no one bosses anyone else around.
It's interesting when you talk about the chimps just now and you talk about these hunter-gatherer societies, and let's say that they're not all exactly the same, but nevertheless, it's kind of like we see things in American and in highly unequal capitalist societies that kind of more resemble the chimps.
Well, absolutely. And we actually, an anthropologist named Bruce Knauf has talked about how political evolution has assumed the shape of a U-shaped curve. That is, high hierarchy at the beginning. The chimps are very, very hierarchical. Bonobos also are, a bit less so. Then, for many, many millions of years, presumably, we've lived as egalitarians, these hunter-gatherers. And especially for the last 250,000 years, we can be quite sure that we were egalitarian, because that's the only system that would work for large game hunting. And we know that large game hunting is phased in at a quarter of a million years ago. So up until about 12,000 years ago, the entire world was egalitarian. Equality ruled. And what happened with farmers was that they came to have higher population densities. They had greater needs for command and control. And although most of the farmers remain tribal and egalitarian even down to this day, a few of them developed chiefdoms and then kingdoms and then early civilizations. And at that point, our U-shaped curve goes way up again and humanity is headed for a great deal of hierarchy. And interestingly enough, we have perhaps two types of society today in the world, one of which is democratic and one of which is autocratic, or whatever you want to call it, totalitarian. There are a lot of names for that other type. And basically, a democratic society is an attempt to make a hunter-gatherer egalitarian society out of a huge, huge society that needs a lot of command and control. And so what we've done, in effect, is to make our societies as egalitarian as they can be and still keep enough command and control to run the place. And that's why we have democracies with checks and balances, but we do have presidents and they do have armies at their command. But we also have very strict codes of individual rights and so forth. And this all reflects our egalitarian background. We're trying to do the same thing in a much larger society where it can't be done with a vengeance the way hunter-gatherers do it.
And it can't be done just because it's too big, it's too anonymous. I mean, the mechanisms that you describe in the book that hunter-gatherers use have to do with basically ganging up on each other and things that can be done in small groups where you can all see each other.
Yes, the hunter-gatherers actually do things by consensus. They never vote. They make all their decisions by consensus. And unless everyone agrees, they can't make a decision. A democracy couldn't afford that. And that's why we have voting by majority. And it's why we have, in theory at least, a loyal opposition. When the opposition is not loyal, as is very much the case in the United States today, then you get gridlock and the system doesn't work very well.
What do you mean by a loyal opposition?
A loyal opposition means that in a democracy you take a vote, and it's always assumed that there are rules to the game, and the rules are the majority is going to rule, and the minority is not going to go up in arms and start fighting, or even, hopefully, it won't be doing what's happening today in Congress, but rather it will work with the majority to achieve the decision. So the decision's made by a majority, but everyone's supposed to go along. And in a hunter-gatherer group, of course, with a consensus system, either everyone agrees on the decision in the first place or nothing happens at all.
And when that is witnessed, when you anthropologists who are in the field are witnessing that, does it take forever?
It's very interesting. One person will speak, then another person will speak, then a third person maybe, usually senior males, but sometimes females. And as the conversation goes along among group members, there's a feeling as to whether they're heading toward a consensus or not. And you can have opposition polemics along the way, but if these people are willing in the end to say, okay, I don't want to keep the group from making a decision, so I'll go along, then you've got a consensus. Consensus doesn't mean a perfect consensus. It means everyone in the group agrees with the majority decision, but everyone has to agree and get on board. So it's not that different from a voting situation, and yet it is at the same time.
In the hunter-gatherer societies that you know of, are there any that are egalitarian in terms of gender?
Of the type that existed a quarter of a million years ago, probably not, because those would be mobile hunter-gatherers who do not have any connection with agriculture, obviously, because it wasn't invented yet, and are economically independent. The most outstanding case of gender equality among hunter-gatherers is the Agta in the Philippines. These people kill wild animals and trade the meat with agriculturalists or horticulturalists who would not have existed prehistorically. And they trade back and forth so that they have mutual advantages, and we call this a symbiotic relationship. Now, unfortunately, the Agta can't be projected into prehistory because of this, but what actually happens with the Agta is very interesting. One of the favorite meat sources for the Agta is wild boar, one of the most dangerous animals to hunt that exists. Women go out in all-women groups with dogs that turn the boars, and they spear them. They take children along, and if some of them watch for the kids while the others are hunting the most dangerous animal hunters ever go after, practically. And interestingly enough, this reflects in their everyday life. The women have very strong positions within the family, and they have a full voice in making group decisions, unlike most hunter-gatherers, which has led me, although I haven't published on this, to think that it may be that it's the hunters, not the males, who have the main role in the groups, and that if women are full hunters, they're going to have a full political role. But unfortunately, we don't have many examples like this.
Very interesting. We're talking to anthropologist Christopher Bohm about his book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Let's talk about selection. This is something that you go into in the book. There's natural selection, there's social selection, there's what dog breeders do, which is a very specific kind of selection that goes into breeding animals of various, all domesticated kinds. Explain to us what you mean by social selection.
Well, natural selection is simply a blind process, which is basically what got us here and every other living being. And it simply means that you have gene pools and you have individuals, and the individuals are variable. And the more successful individuals are going to have their genes proliferate at a greater rate than the less successful individuals. Social selection is a bit more complicated, and it's only really seen strongly in humans. And here is one example of social selection. Hunter-gatherers have a profound distaste for bullying behavior because this encroaches on everyone's autonomy as a threat, at least as a potential threat. And therefore, they punish bullies mercilessly. Capital punishment is used. Also, ostracism, kick them out of the group. These have a telling effect on the reproductive success of the worst bullies. And we have to assume that whatever problems we have with bullying on the school ground today, they'd be a lot worse if it weren't for all the social selection that's taken place for at least hundreds of thousands of years.
So do you mean that people who were bullies 100,000 years ago, let's say some dude's a bully, by the time he gets to the age where he could marry or reproduce or whatever, he's not going to because he's been kicked out or shunned? No girl's going to have his kids?
Well, a bully might actually be attractive to somebody if he's powerful and a good hunter as well. So it's not exactly that the bully is going to be not chosen by individuals, but the group is going to kill him. And that's where he loses out reproductively. So it's really group punishment. And that is a form of social selection.
But it's only social selection if the guy actually gets killed.
Well, no. If he's ostracized, he's then denied cooperative relationships that are important to his subsistence, and that's going to cut down his reproductive success a little. And all these things add up. So it isn't just execution, but also other kinds of punishment. If the group shuns him because he's a bully, and this would be done in the ultimate form by actually deserting him or kicking him out, then he's off on his own and another group may not want him. So again, his genes are not going to prosper.
Is there a gene for altruism? Is there a gene for bullying? Is there a gene for somebody who's a psychopath?
To the extent that we can find physical anomalies that associate with psychopathy, the answer is yes. We don't know the genes, but we do know that the paralimbic portion of the brain, where emotions originate to a great extent, are anomalous in psychopaths. And therefore, we must assume that this has to do with genetics. But genetics just hasn't reached the point where we can talk about a behavior gene that we've identified for this or that. There are very few behavior genes.
So we assume that there might be a kind of altruism gene, but we can't point to it.
Or a bunch of genes that contribute to altruism and maybe do other jobs as well, in which case we have a tangled mess, which it'll probably take 20, 30 years to sort out.
Which isn't all that long.
Oh, no, not at all.
Now, what are free riders?
Well, when we get back to the problem of altruists and why altruists don't stick around in theory, even though we've got them going to blood banks every day, the free rider is the main problem. And the free rider has been conceptualized by a famous biologist named George Williams as a cheater. The free rider is someone who will see an altruist and instinctively know how to take advantage. That is, get the altruist to give stuff to me, but I don't give it back. In which case, free-riding genes should swamp altruistic genes, and pretty soon there are almost no altruistic genes in the gene pool. Again, our problem is, why is it that people give blood anonymously, adopt children in Africa, respond to Sally Struthers imploring TV spots, and so forth? And believe me, Sally Struthers is an expert in bringing out the altruism in people. That's why people are spending money to have her on TV, or used to. So the free rider has always been a cheater, and what I introduce in my book is the idea that bullies are probably more serious free riders than cheaters. A cheater, all you got to do is, if an altruist develops a cheater detection capacity, which is the next logical step when you have this competition going on, altruists should be able to spot a free rider and avoid him. They can't avoid a bully. It doesn't matter whether you can spot the bully or not. The bully's there and he's got force. So getting rid of bullies through groups that formed moral codes against bullying, well, they also punish cheaters. So groups punish cheaters, and they also punish bullies. And in the case of the cheater, individuals also can watch out for them because they're able to spot a cheater. In the case of the bullies, they really have to get together and put the bully down. And that's what is done through social selection. Now, there's a second type of social selection that I can talk about, and that is reputational selection. And here's how it works. A person is known as an altruist. Another person is known as being highly selfish. Who is going to be chosen as a marriage partner? Who is going to be chosen as a partner in subsistence if you're going out hunting or gathering? It's going to be the altruist. Now, it's more complicated than that because the altruist will tend to choose other altruists, either as marriage partners or as subsistence partners in a hunting band. And the leftovers, which are the selfish guys, are going to have to be stuck with each other. And if you look at the cooperative dynamics between a pair of altruists and a pair of selfish free riders, the altruists are going to do much better because they're much better cooperators. So this is the second type of social selection. So one is punitive and done by the group, and the other is done through group choice.
This assumes monogamy.
Monogamy has never been a huge human trait, even though theoretical monogamous marriage is universal. You just have to look at some slippage, and there are also cheater detection mechanisms by which spouses try to keep track of each other. Groups also may punish serious adulterers. It's variable by different hunter-gatherer bands, but some of them punish adultery severely, some of them wink at it. But overall, adultery is not a total free ride. It does have consequences.
We are beginning to understand what groups get out of being made up of altruists. What do individuals get from being altruistic? What benefit is there for them?
An altruist, as an individual, gets chosen as a marriage partner, as subsistence partner, sometimes as a leader. Leaders in hunting bands are supposed to be very humble and generous. Generosity is a huge part of it. So a generous person gives some stuff away, but then when that generous person has hard times, the people who have been given things by the generous person are going to reciprocate. And so if you're snake bit and you can't make a living, or you're sick or injured, if you've been generous in the past, it may save your life. So the net value of your generosity is huge, even though it cost you something along the way.
We're talking to Christopher Bohm about his book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. We're talking about morality, and when you look at human societies, there does seem to be quite a bit of variation in morality. We look at the various fundamentalisms and the liberalisms and so on that we're struggling with today. Is there any universal morality?
Anthropologists have been on a kick for about the last 100 years of focusing on differences among different cultures. And it's been fairly unpopular to look for universals because people feel that universals sort of smack of determinism and human freedom is less and so forth. I myself, being connected with biology and also just of having looked at chimps for so long, I'm a great advocate of there being human universals, and I'll enumerate a few of them. One is that murder is always frowned on by human groups and seriously frowned on. Incest is always highly problematic, at least mother, son, and father-daughter incest. brother, sister, we can make special waivers for people that are so holy that they can't marry anybody else. But incest is another universal moral prohibition. Cheating, lying, things that unravel the fabric of society. People everywhere are smart enough to see that this happens and to make rules against it. So morality has a lot of very, very basic rules that you'll find in any hunter-gatherer band, in any modern society, even in criminal societies. Criminal societies still require a certain degree of trust, for example, so cheating is bad. Murder within the group is treated very differently than murder without the group, and so forth. So there are quite a few major human universals. And morals, on the other hand, can go all over the place with respect to less basic kind of rules, because once you're in the habit of making rules, you start making them up about all kinds of stuff. For example, eating dead people is considered to be horrible some places and normal elsewhere and very special elsewhere, where it's a ritual eating of part of the body as part of a death ceremony, for example, that helps the spirit of the person to go on somewhere. So we have great variability in many of our morals. And what has been less really focused on is the basics that I've just spoken of.
Now, the basics, which certainly makes sense to me, and, you know, when you were talking about murder, I was thinking, yeah, it's murder is frowned upon except when you're killing the bully, or except when you're killing mass numbers of people in war, or except when a cop is killing somebody. There's exceptions to that.
Oh, yeah. And moral rules often have exceptions. There are, for example, hunter-gatherer groups in which twins are killed regularly. And the reason for this is that a woman can't handle two children at the same time because they're nomadic and they've got to carry everything everywhere they go.
So they kill them both?
Sometimes one and sometimes both. And there's infanticide practiced widely among hunter-gatherers, especially in the Inuit, where they need to keep sons to support them in their old age, and a daughter, on the other hand, will be supporting someone else. Therefore, there's a high rate of female infanticide in some groups. So killing within the group is not simply a pure no-no, but killing someone in a context that is socially disapproved of is a major no-no and a universal no-no.
Now, okay, so murder, incest, and so on, the things that you see as universals, do you see those also among other primate communities?
No. Chimpanzees don't even seem to understand death very well, for example. And there has never been a case of a chimpanzee being punished after killing another chimpanzee. And chimpanzees don't have consciences, and that's something we haven't talked about that's a major focus of the book, but maybe this is a good point to bring it in. If you look at a dog that you know well, you may fantasize that the dog feels guilt or shame. And I'm afraid, although we can't prove it, that these feelings are not present in other animals, including even ones closer to us like chimpanzees, or ones that are very much like us, even though they're not phylogenetically close, like dolphins or elephants. These animals do not internalize the rules of their group. And that's something humans do. We do it unless we're a psychopath. Psychopath, because of that very flat level of emotion from coming out of the paralimbic system, largely, they don't identify emotionally with the rules of their group. Therefore, if they kill somebody, they know everyone else is against it, but they don't have a feeling that makes them feel badly about it. And in fact, if you go to a prison, as Kent Keel has down at the Mind Institute at University of New Mexico, and MRI prisoners, and you have a way of sorting them out between the psychopaths and the normal guys who just happen to kill somebody in a fit of anger, the normal guys all feel remorse. The psychopaths feel nothing, neither at the time when they do it nor afterwards.
And as you talk about in the book, a lot of psychopaths are not murderers. They're con men. They're people who are, and they're more male than female, and they tend to, you know, rip widows off of their entire fortune and feel nothing.
Yeah, and they also very often are involved in burning bed situations. That is, they completely tyrannize a wife who, thinking it's a normal guy and he's going to reform someday, well, good luck. And psychopaths, in a sense, are like chimpanzees. They don't have an internalization of moral rules with feeling that makes them feel shamed or guilty or remorseful. They don't have those feelings. And a chimpanzee, especially ones that are raised in human households by humans who are moralistic, still don't pick this up. So apparently they don't have the moral capacity, and it is really a biologically evolved capacity that we have that makes us almost automatically, a normal person at least, absorb the rules of their group, identify with those rules, and feel badly if they break them, even if they're not discovered. Now, it doesn't mean we can't break a rule. It just means that we've got a conscience that's holding us back.
To what extent does this have to do with language? And in general, what is the role of language? I mean, you write quite a bit in the book about gossip.
Well, gossip is one of my favorite topics because any anthropologist, the only way you go to the field and get good information is by becoming an incredible gossip. And I must say, after I came back from the field, I used to watch soap operas just because I wasn't getting enough gossip in my normal everyday life. Gossip is much more than a sort of mean, vicious, backbiting endeavor. It involves, in hunter-gatherer bands, members of the band having a way in which they can very privately and safely find out who are the bad guys in the group, who might have done something bad which hasn't been discovered yet, who's getting out of hand and may need some dealing with, but it's a person that you're scared of. So you do it privately in gossip situations, which are usually dyadic or just a few people. They trust each other, and they can explore these things very privately. Eventually, as gossip flows through the group and moves around and around, of course, the people being gossiped about are not going to hear it, but everyone else is. Eventually, the group can come to a consensus. So-and-so is a bully. We've got to take him out. That's something you could never discuss in front of that person. So gossip is an incredibly important tool of small groups in their social control. It also keeps you informed, so you know who the cheaters are. So your cheater detection capacity is enhanced by communication because people pool their knowledge and say, oh yeah, he did the same thing to me, so it's a pattern.
The universal moral rules that we have is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Is that also a universal human thing?
Yes. I've only spoken so far about proscriptions, which are basically no-nos. But it's interesting that every single hunter-gatherer group that I've studied has preachings, sayings, or just admonitions people give to one another that they should be generous to people even if they're not kinsmen. They also preach in favor of being generous within the family. And the reason they do these things is that they are oiling the wheels of cooperation. And what they realize is that if you nag people to be generous, they're going to be more generous than if you don't. And if you nag them to be generous, you'll have fewer squabbles within families that disturb the entire group, and you'll have better group cooperation, as with sharing meat among everybody in the group. So golden rules are very useful to hunter-gatherers, but you find this type of admonition in farming horticultural tribal people. You find it in the early civilizations. Every single one of the six original civilizations has sayings that are golden rule type sayings. You find it in all the major religions, Confucianism, Judeo-Christian, and so forth. So this is a way in which people try to get other people to be more generous. And of course, you could say in a way it's selfish, but it also is building cooperation in the group.
There's a funny East meets West, or doesn't meet West, thing that I have noticed with that, and that is that the Western way is to nag or guilt trip people into being good to each other, and the Eastern way is to send them to meditation till it comes naturally. So in other words, it comes from within rather than from being nagged to do it. And I wonder, it leads to a contemplation of our nature, because I think the Eastern way is that our deepest basic nature is generous and kind and empathetic and not selfish. And the Western way would probably say, well, we are very selfish and we have to take very strong measures to fight that in ourselves.
Well, you may have something there, but I wouldn't overdraw it, because, for example, the very earliest Chinese civilization had "do unto other" type of sayings. And these sayings clearly are manipulative. They are basically assuming people are selfish, therefore they need to be goaded in the direction of generosity and generousness. And the same would be true for the Indus Valley, the early civilization there. So whatever form these various civilizations and religions have reached today, certainly their roots involved a certain amount of suspicion about human nature and the necessity of addressing the selfishness and compensating for it, as it were, preemptively. And I think that also fits with the Darwinian view of humans, that we're primarily egoistic. Secondarily, we're going to be good to our kids as nepotists, and altruism is relatively weak compared to the other two. Therefore, it needs to be bolstered. And one way of bolstering it could be putting people into a worldview in which meditation and so forth are helping them to see themselves as part of a greater whole. But one way or another, you've got to cope with the basic selfishness, which is quite strong in us.
One thing that's pretty clear, I think, about the society that we're living in today is that it's kind of working on these double standards that it hasn't really integrated. So it rewards selfishness in terms of status and comfort. Selfish people tend to make more money than unselfish people, and at the same time, unselfish people have a greater reputation. So it's confusing and it's uneasy. How do we sort that out as a society?
Well, as a society, we definitely are prepared to punish someone who's selfish to the point of psychopathy.
Right, but we're rewarding Bank of America.
Well, sure, but the capitalist system is based on principles of selfishness. 20 years ago, we had a competing system which basically assumed that people were good and that capitalism was what brought all evil. And interestingly enough, Marx himself had a very, very slim plan for what happened after you got rid of capitalism. You had the withering away of the state because people were basically good, and you would have each according to his needs, etc., etc. And
which sounds like the hunter-gatherer, I must say.
Well, it does, and I suspect that Marx and Engels had read some of the very slim anthropological literature of the time and may have gotten that model. But the problem is that in a large society in which people are not constantly policing each other, and believe me, a hunter-gatherer band is a little police state, in a large society which is anonymous, you have all kinds of things that can happen. Psychopaths can prey on people without being punished because it's such an anonymous society. They get caught once in a while, but there are a lot that don't. We have our standards as capitalists. That is, a Ponzi scheme is bad. But a big bank that is very successful and ruthless is morally ambiguous. Some people.
But a big bank that is a failure gets rewarded and gets money taken out of the taxpayers' pockets to bolster up another failing. And we have many examples of this. And it's so morally painful and awful to any normal person, and yet there's this idea that somehow it's okay.
I would disagree with you on some of that. You say rewarded. I don't think they're actually being rewarded.
Well, they're getting raises in salary, and they're getting tons of money, billions and trillions.
Well, that's a superficial thing that bothers me too. But what they're really getting is they're reaping the benefit of being too large to fail. And I would have hoped to have seen, after what happened in the last 4 years, that our Congress, speaking for us, would have simply limited the size so nobody was too big to fail, in which case these rewards would have gone bye-bye. But the problem is that we have a government in which lobbying is so effective that they won't be cut down to size. So I don't think they were rewarded. I think we were afraid to let them fail because the whole world would collapse.
Or so it was sold to the public.
Well, I have no idea. I'm not sure even the people who made the decisions really knew the world would fail. They just could see that there's a domino effect with banks, and there have been in the past. But at any rate, the morality involved of these people being rewarded after they have basically created catastrophes by taking on imprudent risks and sometimes very dishonest risks, we simply don't want to punish them. And I don't know what's wrong with our society. You'd think that people would be up in arms about this, but we have a democracy and our populace basically lets this go by.
Christopher Bohm is director of the Jane Goodall Research Center and professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He's the author of the book Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it was a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope we can do it again.